Week with George Stephanopoulos starts right now.
Alarming acceleration.
We are facing a serious problem.
COVID rising across the country. More U.S. cases in the last week than in any week since the pandemic began.
We're not in a second wave. We're still in the first wave.
I'm absolutely terrified that we're going to overwhelm the health care system.
States now reversing course on reopening.
We find ourselves careening toward a catastrophic situation.
The White House downplays the threat.
We're in a much stronger place.
Our guest this morning, America's top elected Democrat, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, and Arkansas's Republican Governor Asa Hutchinson. And
Joe Biden is leading President Trump by 14 points.
There's a huge wow factor to looking at these polls.
President Trump's poll numbers tanking after months of crisis.
We're doing, I think, very well. We just started.
It's like a child. Can't believe this has happened to him.
Can Trump come back, surprise everyone again? Or is Biden poised to put this race away? Insight and analysis from 538's Nate Silver and our Powerhouse Roundtable.
From ABC News, it's This Week. Here now, Chief Anchor George Stephanopoulos.
Good morning and welcome to This Week. More than 5 months ago, the first case of COVID-19 was confirmed in the United States. But as we come on the air this morning, the pandemic's grip on our country appears to be as strong as ever. Almost 43,000 new cases reported Saturday. Four states hit new daily highs. Five have set new records for hospitalizations. More than 40 states marking higher weekly averages than last week, with new records set nearly every day. Overnight, the number of cases worldwide topped 10 million, more than one out of four right here in the United States. We all had hoped the worst had passed, and thankfully, the mortality rate of the virus is coming down. But the notion that America could reopen quickly without consequence has now evaporated. Hard-hit states like Florida and Texas are starting to reverse their reopening plans. Several more putting plans on hold, as Dr. Anthony Fauci warns of outbreaks across the South and West that could spread across the country. That came at Friday's press briefing from the White House, the first one in almost 2 months. Notably, the president did not attend, but after canceling a weekend trip to his country club in New Jersey, he offered this positive take.
We're making a lot of progress with the whole situation that came in from a place called China. You probably know, you probably see, but we have a little work to do, and we'll get it done.
And we are joined this morning by the Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi. Madam Speaker, welcome to This Week.
Morning.
Hey, let's start out with this COVID crisis. It's pretty clear we are failing in this country to stop the spread. How do we fix it?
We can fix it by passing the HEROES Act, which we haven't. A major pillar of it is to open our economy by testing, tracing, treating, isolating, wearing masks, washing your hands. There is a way to do it. And instead of what the administration did, deny, delay, death, we have to, it's time for this administration to take this seriously. As Dr. Fauci said, we have a serious problem ahead. Take this seriously. We are 4% of the world's population. We are 25% of the cases and the deaths. 25%. We have the worst record of any country in the world, and the president says we're making progress or whatever. So this is life and death, and we do have a plan to again reverse this trend as well as to kill off this virus. We don't have a vaccine, and we don't have a cure. God willing and science enabling, we will sometime soon. But until we do, we have the tools to halt the growth of this.
Is it time to mandate the wearing of masks across the country?
Oh, I definitely long overdue for that. And my understanding that the Centers for Disease Control has recommended the use of masks, but not required it because they don't want to offend the president. And the president should be example. You know, real men wear masks. Be an example to the country and wear the mask. Not only it's not about protecting yourself, it's about protecting others.
You said you don't know what the Russians have on President Trump, but do you believe they have something on him?
Well, how else would you explain his refusal to even to ignore again and again the intelligence that puts right at the Russian doorstep the involvement into our elections, for example. Now he's saying this is fake news. Why would he say that? Why wouldn't he say, let's look into it and see what this is? Giving money to the Taliban, a bounty on the lives of our troops in Afghanistan. How do you answer to the families of those whose family members are serving there? And he's engaged in peace negotiations with the Taliban, and he's kissing up to Putin in every way, saying he should be in the G7, even though he annexed Crimea and caused death and destruction in Ukraine. So totally irresponsible. Something is wrong with this picture. But putting that other aside for the moment, let's just dwell on this. We hear also that the administration is considering diplomatic response to this or sanctions to this. Well, they either know about it or they don't know about it. The American people need to know what that is.
Before we go, I do want to ask you a little bit about the 2020 presidential campaign. You've seen all these polls this week showing Vice President Biden opening up a lead, former Vice President Biden opening a lead over President Trump. President Obama has warned Democrats not to get complacent. What is the greatest threat to Joe Biden's chance right now?
Well, I do believe that we have to put one good day in front of another. I take nothing for granted. 128 days, no wasted time, no underutilized resources, and no regrets the day after the election. And again, we saw what overconfidence did in 2016 and the horror that exacted onto the country. This election has everything at stake. Anytime we've said this is the most crucial election of our time, we thought it was true, but it just keeps getting more so. So I do believe it's going to be as long as we protect the vote. So if you ask what stands in the way, not the enthusiasm of the American people, not the excellence of our candidate for president of the United States. We're so proud of Joe Biden. He will be a great president. And all of the other candidates, I'm so proud of our House candidates. Hopefully we also win the Senate, which is very possible. But protecting the vote from the voter suppression that the Republicans know they can't win on the natural, so they have to engage in voter suppression and stand in. You look at their playbook and you'll see what they're afraid of, and that is the votes of the American people. We'll own the ground, we'll mobilize, we'll get out the vote, and we will have a victorious election come November, putting one good day in front of another.
Madam Speaker, thanks for your time this morning.
My pleasure. Thank you.
We're announcing today a joint travel advisory. People coming in from states that have a high infection rate must quarantine for 14 days. It's only for the simple reason that we worked very hard to get the viral transmission rate down. We don't want to see it go up.
Of course, I understand where Governor Cuomo is coming from, but whenever you're looking at growing our economy, trying to restore our economy, this is not particularly helpful to that.
New York's Andrew Cuomo going head-to-head with Arkansas's Asa Hutchinson after Cuomo announced a quarantine for travelers from new coronavirus hotspots across the Sun Belt, including Arkansas. And Governor Hutchinson joins us this morning. Governor, thank you for joining us this morning. So was Governor Cuomo justified or not?
Well, I think he's understandable as to where he's coming from. They've had such a huge challenge there in New York City. We sent our nurses up there to help them during that time of crisis. I understand where they're coming from. And in fact, we had had the same order in Arkansas that travelers from New York had to quarantine. We've lifted all of those now because this virus has become like a fog going across the United States. Sometimes slowly, sometimes rapidly. So we're just going to do better to get our cases down in Arkansas. But ultimately, we can't be putting these restrictions on each other across the country because we do have to do two things, both manage the virus and manage the growth of our economy. And ultimately, whenever you see growth of cases from Texas to California, I don't think New York wants to isolate themselves from every region of commerce that might have a spike in cases.
Both Texas and California have put their reopening plans on pause, at least some of them, as well as the state of Florida. Your cases have jumped about 25% in the last week. Will you be putting any pauses in place on your reopening?
Well, we haven't announced anything additional that we're going to do. We can go into phase three. We're not going to do that. So we are on pause on that until we make sure that we get a handle on our current cases. And so we are, in effect, on pause in that way. But we are continuing to move our economy, and that's important to be able to go into the future, both handling the virus and living life, and that's what we're trying to do. But this is a very, very serious challenge we have right now. And just let me emphasize, we've doubled the amount of our testing nationally. We've got to double it again. That is probably the most important thing that we can do, and I'm concerned as a state, while we've increased our testing dramatically in Arkansas with the demand for testing from California and some of the Texas, some of the high population states, how is our commercial providers going to keep up with that? I really think we need to look at a greater use of the Defense Production Act so that we can make sure the supply keeps up with the demand that we know is going to continue growing.
So you think the national effort has to be stepped up?
Yeah, the president's done a very, very good job of utilizing the Defense Production Act when it comes to managing the production of ventilators, making sure that we have that capacity. We need to continue to use that in the areas of the supplies for testing. The demand is only going to increase. And if we are going to have school, which we plan on doing next year, if we're going to have other activities that we like in society, it all depends on the ability to test and know what the radar shows is where the virus is, so we can go in and isolate it. We can trace it down. That's how you live life. That's how you manage the economy, but at the same time, minimize the risk of the virus.
It's now mandatory to wear face masks in the city of Little Rock. The mayor passed that executive order. Why not extend that to the whole state?
Well, we're encouraging mask wearing. I've set the example for that. That's a very important part of the equation versus mask wearing as well as social distancing. So we urge that at every point that we can. We're not going to pass a mandate that is unenforceable. So as we educate the population, we'll continue that effort because it is an important part of the equation. I've got a good relationship with the mayors. We're all trying to accomplish the same thing, which is encourage the use of masks that helps protect others and is a very unselfish act to do.
Should the president and vice president be doing more to set an example on the wearing of masks?
Well, I saw the vice president as he went into the briefing the other day. He had a mask, as others did. I think that's a good example. It is important that there is a consistent national message to take this seriously, that we are going to wear masks, that we're going to set that example. That consistent national message supplements what we're trying to do in the state and is important to what we're... You can have two messages at the same time. Your message is, let's grow our economy, but let's also have the message of social distancing, protecting ourselves and others from the virus.
On another subject, Mississippi is set to remove the Confederate symbol from the state flag. Governor Tate Reeves, your colleague, has said he would sign the bill. Is it time for Confederate monuments in the state of Arkansas to come down?
Well, we've already moved one in Bentonville, which is my hometown. There was a Confederate statue in the square. There was an agreement reached, which took some time to do, to move that statue to an area in a cemetery away from the public square. That's the right process to go through. It's not the right process to destroy by acts of violence or vandalism. It is right to have the debate and to take action. And so, yes, I think there's more that we need to look at in Arkansas. And I thought Mississippi, they did it in a thoughtful way. They set the process up, and I applaud them for their debate and the decision-making that they did. That will continue across the country, and it is the right thing to do.
But your personal opinion is that they should come down?
Well, you have to, which one are you talking about? Whenever you're looking at those in municipalities, we have one in Hot Springs. That's a local decision. Whenever you look at the ones that is relates to the state, we do have one that's on our state capitol grounds. That's a decision of the General Assembly. What do I think about it? I think it's time to look for other places that we can know that history and remind ourselves of the lessons of that history.
Finally, sir, I wanted to talk about the 2020 race coming up. President Trump, you've seen the national polls. He won Arkansas by 27 points last time. I saw one poll this week that showed him only 2 points up right now. If it's a close race in Arkansas, that's a sign of real trouble for President Trump. What should he do to fix it?
Well, he's going to do fine in Arkansas. He will carry Arkansas. And you just got to look at President Trump and the fact that he's been down in the polls. Nobody thought he was going to win the last election. He surged in the final days. He won the some of the key battleground states. And so people who are writing his obituaries a little bit early on that. And I think the key is the economy. And the key is, of course, managing this virus. And, you know, whatever he was doing, he was engaged in it, doing his national briefings. People were responding to that, even though he made some missteps in it. But he's got to be engaged both in moving the economy forward, but also in making sure that we're going the right direction and doing all we can to support the states in terms of the virus.
Governor Hutchinson, thanks for your time this morning.
Hey, I'm Andy Mitchell, a New York Times bestselling author.
And I'm Sabrina Kohlberg, a morning television producer. We're moms of toddlers and best friends of 20 years.
And we both love to talk about being parents, yes, but also pop culture.
So we're combining our two interests by talking to celebrities, writers, and fellow scholars of TV and movies.
Cinema, really.
About what we all can learn from the fictional moms we love to watch.
From ABC Audio and Good Morning America, Pop Culture Moms is out now wherever you listen to podcasts.
Wednesday night on ABC, Brittany Griner, for the first time since being released from a Russian prison, shares her story.
You've been told to go through your bag, and you felt...
Felt the cartridge.
What were you thinking at that moment when you felt that?
My life is over right here.
Her sentence.
Just been told you're going to be 9 years in one of the worst prisons in Russia.
I was just so scared for everything, because there's just so much unknown.
Brittany Griner, Robin Roberts, Prisoner in Russia. Wednesday night at 10, 9 central on ABC.
Whatever it is that we've done so far to help Joe Biden get elected, we have to do more. We can't be complacent or smug or sense that somehow it's so obvious that this president hasn't done a good job. Because, look, he won once.
A warning to Democrats from President Obama in the wake of weeks of falling poll numbers for President Trump, capped by a striking New York Times poll this week that had Biden up by 14 points nationwide, leading in every one of the six top battlegrounds. So how deep is the hole? Can Trump come from behind the way he did 4 years ago? We asked 538's Nate Silver for his analysis.
Nothing makes me happier than talking about uncertainty. And to be clear, we're still a long way from the election and either candidate can win. But I have to level with you, Trump is starting to get deeper into underdog territory. There are really three things that make his path harder than it was 4 years ago. First, Trump's numbers are on a downward slide in several key swing states. In the 538 averages, he's now down 11 points in Michigan, 10 in Wisconsin, 8 in Pennsylvania, and 7 in Florida. Second, there are far fewer undecided voters today than in 2016. In fact, Joe Biden is already above 50% in national polls. It's pretty rare for that to happen so early. The last candidate to do it was Ronald Reagan in 1984. And in some recent swing state polls, more than half of voters already say they would not even consider voting to re-elect Trump. Third, there's what we call the fundamentals. In 2016, Hillary Clinton was trying to win a third straight term for Democrats amid a mediocre economy. Not so easy, actually. But this time, it's Trump who's on the defensive. 56% of voters are unhappy with Trump's handling of COVID as cases continue to rise in many parts of the country. Voters also haven't liked his reaction to nationwide protests. 63% now disapprove his handling of race relations. And we've seen some of the worst economic data since the Great Depression. So what does Trump have going for him? Well, there's still a fair bit of time between now and November, and there can and probably will be new, unpredictable news stories, some of which might benefit Trump. But I buy that he should be rather worry. This is a deeper hole than he faced at any point in 2016.
What are your top priority items for a second term?
Well, one of the things that will be really great, you know, the word experience is still good. I always say talent is more important than experience. I've always said that. But the word experience is a very important word. It's in a very important meaning. I never did this before. I never slept over in Washington. But I didn't know very many people in Washington. It wasn't my thing. I was from Manhattan, from New York. Now I know everybody. And I have great people in the administration.
President Trump on Thursday night with Sean Hannity. Let's talk about this now with our roundtable, joined by Chris Christie, former governor of New Jersey, CEO of Democracy for America, Yvette Simpson, Rahm Emanuel, former White House chief of staff and mayor of Chicago, and Republican strategist Sarah Fagan. And Chris, let me begin with you. You saw the president get that question on his second term priorities, didn't specify anything when he was talking to Sean Hannity right there. You're in regular contact with the White House. Does the president believe he's losing right now, and what does he need to do about it?
Well, listen, he is losing. And if he doesn't change course, both in terms of the substance of what he's discussing and the way that he approaches the American people, then he will lose. There's no question that while these national polls are less significant in terms of the raw numbers, the trend is obvious. The trend is moving towards Joe Biden when Joe Biden hasn't said a word. Joe Biden's hiding in the basement, not saying anything. No discredit to the vice president. If you're winning without doing anything, why do anything? The president has to change course here, both in terms of the substance and answering that question much better than he did with Sean Hannity in terms of what he wants to do in a second term. And secondly, he needs to approach the American people in a different way than he's been approaching them recently. So I said this last week, George, no doubt the president's an underdog. He's more of an underdog today than he was a week ago. Now, there's 128 days left, as was said by Nate Silver, and there is still a lot of time to go here. President Dukakis, as I said last week, was up over Vice President Bush back in 1988 at this time. So there's still a lot of time to go, but there has to be some fundamental changes that need to be made by the president and his team. If they don't do it, they're in big trouble.
Some real candor there from Chris Christie, Rahm Emanuel. Let me ask you the question I asked Nancy Pelosi. What is the greatest threat to Joe Biden's campaign right now?
Well, if you look at the piece that I would focus on right now, both to accentuate, is Joe Biden's got seniors, the first Democrat to win in his winning 65 and older voters since Al Gore. And if everybody remembers, even though they made fun of this interview, back in Davos, President Trump acknowledged that he was going to look in a second term at Social Security and Medicare. And given the opportunity Democrats have right now with seniors, which is basically a 20-year, one-time historic moment, I would start drilling down on that senior vote. I come from the great Jewish tradition of paranoia, and I think the weakest link when you look at everybody that's gravitating towards towards Joe Biden, seniors are the most vulnerable group because of what they think about the president, what they think about him on economic terms, et cetera. And I would take right now, if I was Joe Biden, and go after that senior vote to solidify it. You have a window of opportunity. They're opening to listening. And I would remind them that in their second term, in Davos, the president himself said he's going to cut Social Security and Medicare. And his own budget 2 years ago was the largest cut in Medicare. I've said it on this show, and that's exactly where I would go right now if I was Joe Biden.
So there's advice for Joe Biden from Rahm Emanuel. Sarah Fagan, how about some advice to President Trump and Republicans from you? Rahm Emanuel talked about the seniors right there. Where he's really falling short right now, though, and looks to be a huge threat, suburban white women who have just abandoned the president.
Well, I agree with what Governor Christie said, but I would add a third thing, which I think complements for Republicans what we need to do to keep seniors and suburban women, as you pointed out, which is to not only draw to lead on coronavirus and race relations and all the things the president needs to step forward on, but also to remind them what they're getting with Joe Biden. Joe Biden is not the leader of the Democratic Party right now. Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren are. He put Congresswoman Ocasio-Cortez in charge of his climate policy. These are not things seniors want to see in America. They may be unhappy with Donald Trump at the moment, but they don't want a Green New Deal. They don't want Medicare for all. They don't want free college tuition for everybody. They understand, because of their wisdom and their experience, that the country can't afford this. Democrats have put no plausible plan to pay for any of these things. And so I think the president needs to do three things. He needs to reassure the country on coronavirus. He needs to put forward a positive agenda for the country. and he needs to remind voters, suburban women and seniors and other important voting blocks to his constituency, just what electing Joe Biden means for the country.
Yvette, you and Democracy for America fought pretty hard for progressives like Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders.
Yeah. I mean, I think the big thing to remember is that most Americans actually support these policies. And so seniors, they don't, they care about their grandchildren. They want to leave the planet better. They want to make sure that their kids are good. They have Medicare. They understand what it's like to have a secure healthcare system. They want that for everyone. But I think the big picture, George, is this enthusiasm gap that we still have against the president, right? He has twice as much energy as Joe Biden does when you think about people who are excited about running. Voting for him. And so we need to mobilize and excite our base. That translates into voter mobilization and the type of resilience we're going to need to overcome the voter suppression and maybe foreign interference that we're going to see in this election. And so I would say he does need to come out of the basement. We need to see him energized. We need to see him have a concrete plan, even if it's digital, for how we're going to get voters to show up. And I think if we do that, I think we win. It's too early. June is too early to call this race. And you know that President Trump is like Teflon. Everything that comes on him, it bounces right off and it doesn't seem to stick at all. So we need to be not planning for, not expecting this implosion by Donald Trump, because I don't think we're going to see it. We need to energize our base and we need to make sure they show up.
Chris, Yvette says she doesn't expect to see an implosion by Trump, but I was struck by something I saw in Politico this morning from Sam Nunberg, who's a longtime political advisor to President Trump. He says that President Trump is facing a possibly historic defeat, and he goes on to quote say, if Trump numbers against Biden erode to 35 percentage points over the next 2 weeks, he's going to be facing realistically a 400-plus electoral vote loss, and the president will need to strongly reconsider whether he wants to continue to run as the Republican presidential nominee. You expect something like that from James Carville, but Sam Nunberg?
George, I don't spend any time, any of my time, because it would be a complete waste of time, listening to Sam Nunberg. He has no idea what he's talking about, and I don't even know why reporters call and talk to him except to get inflammatory, ridiculous quotes like that. The best news I've heard this morning is what Yvette just said. Listen, for Republicans, we need to get Joe Biden out there and campaigning. When he does, he will make mistakes. He will misspeak. And Yvette just put it out there, but in a very nice way. The liberal wing, the progressive wing of the Democratic Party is very, very suspicious of Joe Biden. They didn't support him during the primary season. They didn't want him as the nominee. And that's why Joe Biden's just trying to sit on his lead right now. Now, if I were him, I wouldn't do anything different. But it's the Republicans' job to put forward, as Sarah said, a forward-looking agenda for the next 4 years so that Biden will be forced to come out and tell people what his agenda is. When he does, it will divide the Democratic Party. Rahm will want certain things to be said. Yvette will want very different things to be said. And if they can't come together, that's going to be a big problem for Joe Biden.
From ABC News, it's This Week. Here now, Chief Anchor George Stephanopoulos.
Sarah Fagan, we saw the president deny that he was briefed. Also, the director of national intelligence denied that he was briefed. Did not deny the intelligence. But in some ways, the president is damned and the White House is damned if they do, damned if they don't here. It's also a problem for the president if the intelligence community had this intelligence and he wasn't briefed.
Yeah, it is a real problem if that's, in fact, the truth. But we don't know what the truth is. So I think the president should call for figuring that out. If the intelligence is true, and if Russia is doing this or has done this, the United States needs a very strong response. Sanctions, other measures, disinvite Putin from the G7. Absolutely. That is a disgrace by Russia, and the United States should have a very strong response. But I will point out that there's such a desire among the left to tie Donald Trump to Russia. It's almost, even for credible conservatives, it's almost hard to believe any of these reports, because it seems to be almost a North Star for the party.
Yvette, we heard Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi double down on this suggestion that the Russians have something on President Trump.
You look, the Trump-Putin love affair is well documented, so I just want to disagree with Sarah. This is not some hoax that, you know, the left has come up with. We know that he was more than willing to allow Putin to interfere with our democracy. Now it looks like he's also willing to allow him to infiltrate and damage our military.
There's no evidence to suggest
that. So I think the Bolton interview, which I know was done.
That's ridiculous.
Yeah, there's no evidence.
The Bolton interview that was actually done from an insider. I'm sorry, go ahead, Sarah.
Well, I was just going to say, look. Again, You know, this is the North Star of the Democratic Party, is to tie Donald Trump to Russia, when there's been several investigations, none of which have been able to tie any criminal conspiracy. Yes, the Russians were absolutely trying to interfere with our election in 2016. And Donald Trump signed sanctions into law because of that. So we should also point that out. So this obsession with tying Trump to Russia, you know, really is ridiculous. And so, look, there's reasons to criticize Donald Trump. I just don't think this is one of them.
Chris, how should he be handling this new story coming out of the New York Times?
Well, what should matter is the truth of what happened. The president's saying he was not briefed about it. If he wasn't, he better find out why he wasn't briefed about it, if the report is true. And let's remember something. The New York Times, breathlessly, George, reported about Russian collusion. In fact, I think he even got a Pulitzer over it. And as it turns out, Bob Mueller then says there was no Russian collusion between the two.
Well, he said there was no criminal conspiracy. He said there were more than 100 contacts. He said it didn't rise to the level of a criminal conspiracy.
George, 100 contacts. Yeah, but George, listen. Again, that's the Democratic talking point, okay?
I mean, that's what he had in the report. No, it's not a talking point. That's a fact.
He also concluded that none of those things rose to the level of any kind of collusion or conspiracy between the campaign. And I'll bet you this. I'll bet you there were lots of contacts between the Clinton campaign and Russians during that campaign as well. But we didn't have a two-year investigation into the Clinton campaign. So the fact is there has been no proof of that kind of relationship. So now what the president needs to do is not rise to the bait that Rahm and Yvette and others are putting up there and just say to his intelligence community, is this intelligence correct? If it is, why wasn't I told about it? And then if it is correct, to take very aggressive steps against Putin and the Russians for doing anything like that. Aggressive sanctions.
Rahm?
Yeah, well, first of all, let me say this. When we were in the White House, President Obama ordered every other Friday a deep dive into issue. The fact is, this was already the senior members of the foreign policy team met on this. This should have been led to a deep dive on any issue, one particular issue. They know that the president may not read the briefing. Whether he was briefed on it or in the briefing are two separate issues. I think I'll speak for Sarah and Chris. This is of such a level, given the targeting and killing of American men and women in uniform overseas carrying out our mission, that there should be not just White House meetings, but congressional briefings. And I bet you Sarah and Chris would say it's worthy of that level. And I don't think when it comes to killing our men and women, it's just about sanctions. It is also the fact that the whole world watched it. While he knew this, and they knew that we knew this, he was invited to the G7 that would happen this week in the United States. It says a statement about this president and his priorities. Remember, Ronald Reagan said, weakness invites chaos. And that is what's happened here. China's taking advantage of us, and also Russia's taking advantage.
I'm not the
Go ahead, Chris.
This is not a left-wing conspiracy, Chris. This is not a left-wing community.
Hold on, one at a time.
I'm not surprised that you want to believe what's written in the New York Times, lock, stock, and barrel. Okay, I'm not surprised that you want to do that. What I'd like to do is to see people in the administration look into this and decide. You're saying categorically the president knew. Well, the president is saying
that's
he didn't know. So let's find out what the real truth is. I know. Yes, you did. You said the president knew and other people knew he knew. That's what you said. You don't know that to be a fact, and you're putting it out there. It's fine for you to put it out there along with the New York Times, but I think we've seen from the Mueller investigation and the New York Times Pulitzer Prize-winning reporting how valid they really are in many stories.
I'm afraid that is all we have time for today. Thank you all. Thank you all for joining us. That is all for us. Thanks for sharing part of your Sunday with us. Check out World News Tonight, and I'll see you tomorrow on GMA.
Wednesday night on ABC, Brittany Griner, for the first time since being released from a Russian prison, shares her story.
You've been told to go through your bag, and you felt...
Felt cartridge.
What were you thinking that moment when you felt that?
My life is over right here.
Her sentence.
Just been told you're going to be 9 years in one of the worst prisons in Russia.
I was just so scared for everything, because there's just so much up.
Brittany Griner, Robin Roberts, Prisoner in Russia. Wednesday night at 10, 9 central on ABC.